Parents, have you ever stopped to wonder what kind of world your children will grow up in? The ideas shaping our culture today will be the foundation of their future. That's why it's more important than ever to recognize and understand collectivist ideologies. Ideas that may sound good on the surface, but can ultimately erode the very values that make America what it is today. My guest today, Christian Ray Flores, has lived under the weight of these ideologies firsthand. As a child refugee in Chile, raised in Africa, and later a pop star in post-Soviet Russia, he's seen the impact of communism, socialism, and tyranny up close. Now, as a U.S.-based entrepreneur, evangelist, and philanthropist with a master's in economics, Christian brings a unique perspective on freedom, individualism, and the American dream. He's also the author of The Little Book of Big Reasons to Love America, where he shares powerful insights from the lens of an immigrant who has lived under oppression and found freedom here in America. In this episode, we dive into critical conversations about the dangers of collectivist thinking, the value of entrepreneurship, the role of censorship in shaping public perception, and how we can raise resilient, critical thinking children. This is a conversation every parent and educator needs to hear. So let's get into it.
Welcome to the Foundations of Learning podcast. I hope to inspire you to actively participate in your child's learning journey, fostering a love for knowledge and nurturing the skills necessary for success in a rapidly changing world.
I'm honestly very honored to have you on my podcast today because I think that you have such an interesting story to tell. And after reading your book, I could not put it down. And I kept telling my husband, I was like, hold on, I got to read one more line to you. Because it was just such a good book that was informational, but also it obviously told your story. And so if anyone wants to read your book, The Little Book of Big Reasons to Love America, it is on Amazon right now. But it was a great book. So Christian, you were a child refugee in Chile, raised in Africa, and you became a top pop star in Russia. You also had a song, Our Generation, serving as the anthem in President Boris Yeltsin. That's how you say it, right?
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, in his campaign against the communists. And today you are a U.S.-based entrepreneur and philanthropist, and you have a master's in economics, you're fluent in four languages. I mean, you are just doing so many things that is amazing because you came from, you were an immigrant who experienced life under tyranny. So the fact that you are where you are and just thriving in life is, I think, an important message that anyone can take from what you have experienced. So my first thing that I want to kind of go over with you, Christian, is that in your book, you go over, obviously, I know you lived in all of these different places, which were, you know, a communist or Marxist or socialist society, right?
Yeah.
I kind of want to go over with you so that everyone's on the same page, because we use these words, I feel like interchangeably sometimes, like communism, Marxism, socialism,
yeah,
and they're kind of like a form of collectivist ideologies.
Yes.
And so do you personally view them as distinct ideologies, or do they have, or do they share a common thread that ties them together?
They're basically, the best way to understand them is that they're in the spectrum of the same trajectory, basically. And, you know, so Karl Marx is the guy, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels was the guys who sort of created this worldview and produced some seminal works on this and stuff like that. And basically, in their view, socialism is a stepping stone to the utopian final destination, which is communism. Right, so communism is really more of an aspirational utopia goal, ultimate goal. And in their minds, that's reaching that goal and that way of being is sort of this almost like a providential inevitability. That's basically the evolution of humankind goes towards communism, and then socialism is a stepping stone. That's pretty much the idea, you know. And no one has ever built a communist society. They've built versions of what they call a socialist society. That's the stuff that gets propagated, experimented with, etc., in the 21st century.
Yeah, so we're kind of trying to, like, reinvent, essentially, or like change it to meet different needs of whatever our mm-hmm. end goal is kind of what you're saying.
Yeah. 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 So, okay. Yeah. So it's basically the heaven in the communist sort of religion, which is a social religion, is communism. The okay. reality that leads to that is socialism.
Gotcha. So it goes from like socialism to communism, yeah. and then Marxism would mm-hmm. be obviously Karl Marx is the one that deemed.
Yeah. Right, yeah. So he is Marxism is. Yeah. It's basically it's pointing to the origin story. OK, this ideology came from this group of people and people that supported him. Right. And what he thought is that capitalism is completely bankrupt, and it will inevitably be replaced by socialism, which will be replaced by communism. So that's the continuum in their mind.
Got you. Okay. So how do these collectivist ideologies differ from like an individualist ideology? And what are some of the societal implications that these contrasting worldviews have with one another?
Well, one is top down, the other one's bottom up, right? So obviously, the collectivist societies and cultures, they view as the goal of the individual is to promote, amplify, you know, advance the interest of the collective. So the goal of the individual is completely it's underrepresented. It's not valuable, right? The individual is not valuable. The collective is what's valuable. So that's collectivist, that's top-down. Bottom-up, which is, let's say, America is one of the examples of this sort of individual, the sanctity of the individual. It basically says, look, you know, you have been given a specific set of individual preferences, talents, et cetera, and if we create an environment where your talents and your abilities and your passion and your drive and your entrepreneurial quests have freedom to exist, the individuals that make up society will build a society that's much more prosperous, and they will know how to serve each other. So that's the free market, free enterprise approach. The collectivist approach, top-down economically, are usually central planning. So the government says, hey, we need to create, you know, 2 million new apartments because, you know, we have a shortage of, and then they create this sort of top-down system that creates 2 million apartments, let's say. And the idea is that, well, we are much more efficient that way, and because we can, you know, we can make decisions centrally and then benefit a lot of people from it. In practice, that doesn't work on all kinds of levels.
Awesome. Okay, so I'm glad we kind of went through some of that, just because throughout this conversation, I think it's important for people to kind of understand those ideologies, understand like what it is when you're talking mm-hmm. about a collectivist versus individualist ideology, because they are, like you said, they are two very different things. And then also, like I said, Marxism, communism, socialism, all of these words that we kind of throw around sometimes I feel like are used interchangeably. So I think it's important for us to really understand what they are and the differences. So I really want to get into your own experiences, because like I had said, in your book, you kind of go over your whole life story, which is so interesting. And you actually have personal experience under tyranny. You grew up under a tyrannical, well, multiple tyrannical regimes that I would assume profoundly shaped your perspective. Can you share how those experiences influence the person you are today?
I mean, first of all, it gave me a profound distaste for collectivist tyrannical regimes, you know, like, because mm-hmm. you go, okay, you know, I have all these dreams, I have my own talents, I have my own plans, and the state will limit my freedoms very, very intensely, limit my freedom of expression, my freedom of my mobility, my entrepreneurial instincts, all of those things will be limited, and that, I mean, it produces tremendous poverty, misery, mediocrity. It's just all across a miserable existence. So any government that still works in that way, you'll immediately see that it brings a lot of misery to most people, not everybody, but most people, right? So that's one. That's one. So I have sort of this of a rebellious streak, I guess. You know, when I go, nope, I'm not playing those games anymore with anyone, even in the United States. You know, even in a very free society that the United States is, when there's always a temptation for government to lean in and take more power. And so I have very strong feelings about it. And so do actually, if you think about it, ask any immigrant who spend a considerable amount of time in an unfree society, and they'll tell you pretty much the same thing. So yeah, I'm not alone in this, I don't think.
No, I don't think you are at all. And honestly, in reading your book, I would say that you are maybe more American than some Americans, yeah. If that makes any sense at all. Like, you really are, like, as I was reading the book, I was like, he really is like what our founding fathers were, you know, envisioning for our country. I was like, this is Christian. Like, he is more American than some Americans. And I think it's interesting, especially in, you know, what's happening in our country right now. I think we kind of had two different paths that we were kind of going down, and now we're like taking this completely different path. And so I think it's so interesting just in what's happening in our country today, and kind of seeing, as I was reading your book, obviously there were a lot of, I don't know, you could say connections between like what you were seeing in these tyrannical governments that were, you know, from communism or communist societies, and kind of looking at paths that we could have gone down in America and where we're kind of going now. And I feel like we've kind of shifted. I don't think that, you know, anything's going to be fixed quickly, obviously, but I think we are going from more of a communist outlook to a hopefully more individualistic ideology again, which is very, very good, because I've, like I said, in reading your book and multiple other books on the Soviet Union, I think it's very interesting to look at the Soviet Union, that, you know, we have these parallels that are kind of happening in America right now.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and the thing is, that's just usually the, I think the whole world leans either one way or another because of the types of people that maybe dominate the airwaves or the political spectrum, that kind of thing. So, there's definitely a shift. I mean, it's going to be imperfect. And I think one of the benefits of democracy and freedom, free enterprise societies, is that at least in this kind of scenario, the very imperfect, flawed politicians don't shape every aspect of your life. Like, you might not even like the politicians, because the society is free. What we're doing is we're trying to fight for the ability to keep the state out of our lives. So even if the people that are doing it are the, you know, and you might like this player, dislike this other player in the new administration, for example, and I have my own preferences as well. The fact that we are attempting at, you know, make a smaller government, deregulate things, decrease bureaucracies at scale, those things are positive. And unfortunately, I mean, it makes me sad that it came to a point where such dramatic change is sort of has to be done to sort of stabilize the place and not go bankrupt, right? Because it's also going to hurt people, right? It's going to, a lot of people will lose their jobs. A lot of people will be disoriented. It's real lives, real people that are mostly completely innocent in this whole thing, have nothing to do with it. People overseas who are, you know, losing funding for certain things that were good things. So there's a lot of wear and tear, which makes me sad about just on the human level, right? And it's just disappointing that that's what's happening. I mean, you could achieve the same thing through a lot of dialogue and a lot of civil, connective, sort of center focused conversations between the two sides.
Help your child become a confident reader with letters and sounds. This structured curriculum includes lesson plans, games, and multi-sensory activities to make learning letters fun and effective. Get started today at k3homeschoolfoundations.com or check out the link down below.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I like that there is a shift in the way that we are, I think, as a society, getting information as well. And I think that helps when you don't have, you know, one avenue of just getting information, and you can get information from literally anywhere. You can listen to podcasts, you can read books, you can, you know, whoever you want to listen to, and kind of, you can listen to both sides of the spectrum. You can listen to middle ground people. You can listen to so many people that can shape your view of things. And then, like you said, really, it comes down to the individual. Like, that really is the most important piece, is it comes down to the individual.
Exactly. Exactly. And if you think, if you look at tyrannical sort of autocratic regimes, they censor. So you don't have that freedom of choosing, okay, who do you listen to? It's very, very limited. They do their very, very best to just insert this kind of information and messaging, and then suppress, persecute things that they don't like, you know. And so that's, there is no moral equivalence between the two approaches. It doesn't exist, you know.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, obviously America is one of the very few places, even though some people feel like we are still being somewhat censored, and, you know, some information is being, you know, taken off the internet or not being allowed to be shown and different things like that. I do think that we do have the very best so far. Like you said, it's so complex, and it's something that's, you know, never going to be perfect, I don't think. But America is one place where we do have, I think, the most free speech out of any other country right now.
By far.
And I think that's amazing, because it does allow for us to share ideas and really discuss important topics that need to be discussed, whether or not it makes other people uncomfortable or, you know, whatever that is. I think that is the cornerstone, is being the individual and, you know, making choices yourself, and then also being able to have these conversations that, you know, like I said, might not make other people comfortable, but they're important to have.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I grew up where there's zero of that. And I can tell you, and look, if you're in America, it's really interesting how hard it is to appreciate freedom if it's the only thing you know. You know, it's like Wi-Fi, right? Like, you don't appreciate Wi-Fi until you don't have Wi-Fi, and then you're nervous and sort of get a little jumpy and go, hey, how do I get access to the internet? You know, something that didn't even exist like 30 years ago, right? But it's sort of the same thing with freedom. Is part of the reason why I wrote the book, is because, you know, when you grow up, and there's certain things you can't even say in history class at school, and everybody knows, like a 16-year-old knows that there's certain things you don't bring up. I mean, how depressing is that, right? Or if you want to access certain books, they're forbidden. You have to do it sort of in the black market, or movies, or plays. If you can't listen to a certain radio station because there's jamming stations trying to jam it and shut it down. Like, that's the level of control that I've known personally. Entrepreneurship is illegal, for example. That's what it was. Like, you can't buy and sell without the risk of going to jail for something. That sort of thing, right? And so, so I've experienced the extreme version of that, and because I've experienced the extreme version of that, I was so, as you say, American, in the sense that I just absorbed everything from the Western civilization that I could, the attitude, the mindset, the fortitude, the character. I just wanted that, because I knew that those were the places where people prospered. So when I had my first chance, when the Soviet Union fell apart, I attacked life with that kind of spirit, a very American sort of pursuit of happiness kind of spirit. And immediately I had a lot of success, because not a lot of people were doing that at the time, you know. So those of us who were entrepreneurial, who were, you know, curious, who we're not afraid to risk things. We did really well in those years. And then, of course, the country shut down eventually. So it went back.
Yeah, and that's why I truly am like so honored to have you on my podcast, because I think your book, I think your message and everything that you are trying to, I don't know who exactly you're trying to get it to, but I think Americans would highly benefit from hearing your stories, because like you said, when you get used to something, like if you are born in America, you have grown up in America, you've never experienced what you have experienced, then you just take it for granted and you don't realize how important some of these freedoms are and some of these, you know, like our Constitution and the rights that we have within our Constitution and how important they actually are to a free and thriving society. And so I think your message is so important to get out. And I think really, I mean, any person that immigrates to America, right? Like they understand, I think, American values better than Americans, because you guys, you know, you weren't born in it. And so you don't take it for granted.
Yeah. That's very true. And part of the work that I do now, I do high performance coaching for professionals, is actually about that. What you mentioned is like, it's fascinating to me how you can be a well-educated professional in America and not pursue happiness, for example, which is like a core American thing, and settle for certainty rather than settle for opportunity, go for opportunity. So I think we find this phenomenon is that if you were born here, maybe you don't have the intensity of the American spirit that you may have had. So one part of my coaching is essentially an immigrant trying to help Americans be more American, you know, and pursue their dreams, and how to do that practically, how do you change your lifestyle, your habits, how do you aspire for higher, and how do you make a difference?
Yeah, I think that's super important. And I think for some reason, people get into, not for some reason, I think it's just kind of human nature sometimes to get into more of like this like victim mentality, right? Yeah. Of, you know, it's hard to take personal responsibility for your life. Like that is the hardest route, is to actually, you know, say, okay, I'm responsible for my life. I can make different choices, and it might be hard for me to achieve these things, but it's possible. And so I think, I mean, a lot of the things that I see people say is like, well, you know, so-and-so is starting at this point, and so they can't succeed because, you know, this other person is starting here and they have, you know, more of an advantage. And so I can't succeed in that because they have more of an advantage than I do. And it's kind of like this victim mentality that we kind of get into. Mm-hmm. And also we like, you know, to be comfortable. And sometimes, like I said, the route of personal responsibility and taking these risks and chances is way less comfortable than it is to just continue on with what you're doing and not making change.
Yeah. And that's where a lot of the sort of the Marxist ideologies are very interesting, because they mutate like a virus and they adopt to new realities. So, for example, the white privilege sort of idea, that's a very Marxist idea. It's just adapted to the American reality, right? Mm-hmm. And it comes from this idea that, you know, if you're white, and especially if you're male and you were born in America, you have, you know, unfair advantages. Mm-hmm. Well, the problem with that is that, A, that's not how life works at all. Okay, that's not reality. B, you might have actually, you may have advantages if you're white male in America. You may have massive disadvantages if you're white male in America. But it just depends on the person. And also, what's the problem with having advantages or privileges? It's a it's a beautiful thing to have a privilege. Just build on the privilege, serve people, et cetera, et cetera, right? Yep. But for me, like if you ask me, I can refute that very easily, the whole white privilege thing, right? Mm-hmm. Very easily. I am a darker skinned Latino immigrant who had zero privilege. Like 5 years old, I was a refugee. Mm-hmm. I saw a military coup in Chile, civil war in Africa, and the fall of the Soviet Union with tanks in the streets in the 90s in the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. Like my level of privilege, like it's like in the minus, right? Mm-hmm. Well, here's the deal. because I've dealt with danger and oppression and uncertainty and all kinds of stuff like that, I have a character that, and I have more character, more grit, more drive to succeed than the average white male in America. Mm-hmm. So I have, you know, whatever you want to call it, third world privilege in America. I actually mm-hmm. have a totally unfair advantage over the normal middle class white American, because they just don't have that kind of drive.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't. Well, what is that unfair? If by this by the same, you know, by the same token, it then okay, you know, tax mm-hmm. me for that, right? mm-hmm. Sue me for that. Of course not. Yeah. It's ridiculous, mm-hmm. right? Everybody mm-hmm. has disadvantages. Everybody has privileges. Thank God for the privileges. Deal mm-hmm. with the disadvantages and stop being a victim.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, you see this even like with, you know, super wealthy kids. Like if you look at super, super wealthy kids, it's not the case for every single one of them. But if you have a kid that grew up super wealthy, they had everything kind of handed to them. A lot of the time they don't have the, like you said, the grit and the yeah. like ambition to go after things, because everything has always been handed to them. And it's like,
yeah.
you know, easy for them. And no matter what your color is, it doesn't matter. It's just, it kind of feeds this, like, I don't know, a different mindset. Whereas yeah. if you grew up, let's say, super poor, right? Your family mm-hmm. barely had enough food growing up. You know, maybe had problems in your family or whatever, you know, whatever it is, you learn how to adapt and to have the grit, like you said, to change your life. And maybe some of these people don't. Maybe they think, you know, they go into a victim mentality, like, because this happened to me, XYZ, whatever, right? And they don't make mm-hmm. good choices. Yep. And that can also be a possibility, just as the wealthy kid could go on and be super successful, right? And have all of this motivation and grit. So again, like, I really do think that it's so important for us to, just as a society or humans, just to really think about what, instead of getting to that victim mentality, think about every single choice I make has an impact on my life. And I can make bad choices that are going to, you know, not get me where I need to go, or I can make good choices that are going to really help me in my life. And so I think it's, again, it's kind of this individualist ideology of, I have control of my life and nobody else has control of it but me.
Yeah, you have agency. You should have agency. And a society that allows freedom, agency, merit is the society that flourishes, period. Like, that's just true. A society that starts yeah. to control top down and redistribute wealth and work on equal outcome, not equal opportunity, is mm-hmm. a society that stagnates and gets all kinds of messed up, all kinds of messed up.
Yes. And we have so many examples throughout history that show us this, like, again and again and again. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's interesting that we kind of keep trying to go back to that. Do you have any, I guess, I don't know, ideas on why you think we keep going towards a more collectivism type ideology instead of like that individualist ideology? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's because we've always had and always will have people who would prefer to stay in the victim mode. And like, that's just human nature. So it's going to appeal to generation after generation all over the world forever. And also because the ideology is, especially the sort of the socialist brand and that whole spectrum of ideas, it's a secular ideology. So it's not it removes the divine, the supernatural, it removes God and scripture and all of the things that came out of it in Western civilization, that made Western civilization what it is. So it's, in its essence, it's a very anti-Western ideology. And you will see that pop up everywhere. And you usually attach, you know, people that sort of embrace that, they attach some sort of one thing, like one injustice, right, on the surface. And the appeal is that it's very appealing, especially for young people. That's why it's always more popular in colleges, for example, right? Why? Mm-hmm. It's very idealistic. It's the entry point, the appeal of it is compassion for the disadvantaged. And then so it's sort of evil that way because it appeals to the best nature of us, the compassionate part of us. Yeah. But then the solutions are the opposite. They're basically about violence and force and restriction of free will and restriction of choices. And, you know, and it's just a particularly evil brand of, and then it keeps victims as victims. Because it's in the interest of the ideology for the victims to stay victims and to have more victims become victims, essentially, right? Mm-hmm. So it's really scary and depressing, I think, as an ideology.
100%. And I'm an educator here in my state of Utah. I actually quit teaching in public schools, but in my experience in just like going through university and everything, teachers are generally, like, all the teachers I've ever met, they have such big hearts. And so they really want to help people. Like, that's why you go into teaching. You want to, you know, help children. You want to help them succeed and all of these different things. And in my university classes, I think they really feed on the compassion of teachers to then implement, or not implement, but integrate some of these ideologies within what you're learning in university. And that was like my experience. Like, I had to take an entire course on white privilege and basically sit there and be told how I was so privileged and like, because of, you know, this color of my skin, like this, you know, whatever. And so, that's, you know, horrible. I had some classes like that. I had just a bunch of different things that had kind of happened where you have these courses that really go over these ideologies and talk about how, you know, you need to have diverse perspectives in your classroom. And, you know, some kids are more disadvantaged than others. And like really just putting this kind of like in the mindset of educators. Mm-hmm. And I think it's such a disservice that we are doing that to educators, because like I said, they're so compassionate. Like, I can see teachers on social media that are getting very upset because obviously we have ended DEI stuff in public schools, and they're like super upset about it. And, you know, now these kids that need like representation and whatever, they're not going to feel accepted and loved and all of these things. And I can see how the compassion piece of it really gets people down these rabbit holes of, you know, needing to like save these people, and this is how we're going to save them. When in reality, you know, we've got to just look at every single kid, no matter who they are, where they come from, what their skin color is, whatever it is, and just teach them that if you work hard, if you are responsible for yourself and you do everything you can to succeed, it doesn't matter where you come from. If you have, I like to call privileges blessings, honestly, in my opinion, if you have these blessings of like, you know, X, Y, and Z, that's great. Like you said, use those. And maybe you have other things that you have learned in your life, right? Like you talk about, you might have privilege because you grew up in these tyrannical governments that gave you these different skills that others may not have. And you can use those skills to help you succeed. And so I think it's very interesting as going through, you know, college and having to take these courses and then going into the public schools and having different trainings that I had to take that again, just kind of continue on with really what the collectivist ideologies would be. Right. Mm-hmm. And kind of, I don't know how to help keep these kids in a victim mentality. At least that's how I saw it. Right. Like, to them, it was the opposite of like, we're going to help everyone. But in my mind, I'm like, no, we're going to create create a society with a high level of victim mentality if we continue down this route.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's all true. Yeah. Sorry you had to take those courses. It's mind-boggling to me that that was a required thing in the United States of America. It really is.
Parents, have you ever wondered what your kids are really learning about important topics like taxes, freedom, and responsibility? As an educator, I once had to teach a social studies lesson that only focused on the positives of taxes, completely ignoring the downsides of overtaxation or the importance of personal responsibility. It made me realize how limited the perspective is in many traditional curricula. That's why I'm so passionate about the Tuttle Twins books. These books teach kids both sides of important issues like economics, freedom, and entrepreneurship in a way that's fun, engaging, and easy to understand. They help children think critically and understand the world in a more balanced way. If you're ready to check it out, use my link down below to explore their incredible resources, give your kids the tools to think for themselves, and support my podcast.
It was pretty wild. I mean, it was going through these courses as a teacher. Like, I would sit there and I'm thinking, like, I just don't understand what this has to do with me educating the future generation. And it was, and I had to like write papers on it. And, you know, as a college student, I'm thinking about like, I just need this piece of paper so that I can get a job. And yeah, it was really hard. And when I speak out about these things, I am told that I didn't take these courses and that's not happening. And I'm like, no, it definitely is. I had to do them. I lived through it.
Yeah, so you experienced, I mean, in a light mode, what we experienced growing up in these tyrannical regimes. They made you. They would shove things, ideas down your throat. Mm-hmm. And if you don't respond the right way, if you don't answer the right way, if you, the paper doesn't reflect the party line, the official party line, you will be dismissed. You will be oppressed. You will be diminished.
Mm-hmm.
It is an extraordinary evil practice to do that. And it still boggles my mind that it's a thing in the United States. Even in the Army, it's shocking to me.
Yeah, it kind of has its tentacles, I think, in everything. And you really have to look, not that you really have to look for it, but it happens everywhere. I mean, even where my dad worked, he worked for Northrop Grumman, which is obviously like a giant part of the military industrial complex and whatever. But even in that, like, he had to take trainings like that as well, you know? So it's interesting how it just kind of gets everywhere. Like, he's not even,
it's like a virus,
you know,
it
really is. It's like a virus and it just kind of pops up everywhere. So another question I had for you, just because, like, as we're talking about these tentacles that are, you know, going into all parts of our society, in the Communist Manifesto, Karl Marx emphasizes the centralization of finance and the establishment of government-run schools. And given that the U.S. is often considered a beacon of freedom, do you think that these institutions actually undermine the individual liberty?
Government-run schools? Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think, you know, and that's sort of the tension here is this, is scale and efficiency versus depth of quality education, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the public school system, originally the model for the public school system was developed by the Prussians. Mm-hmm. And it was done for the Industrial Revolution because they needed sort of standardized workers to have a minimal education so they can do basic tasks and the assembly line to scale the and the power of the Industrial Revolution is that it created incredible amounts of wealth for everybody. It lifted the West. For the first time in millennia, the West just skyrocketed compared to the rest of the world, et cetera, et cetera. So there's lots of benefits. Well, the downside is that the government-sponsored sort of post-industrial education really is not equipped to create competitive individuals who can compete in the modern and rapidly evolving world. So it's really an industrial, it's sort of a paradoxical system, right? So it's eventually going to go through massive changes, I think. I think the college bubble is going to burst. The cost is just excessive. They don't really teach practical skills in the way that should be taught. And essentially, fundamentally, it's not that it's that it will make you into a robot. It doesn't. You know, I went through public school and I still ended up being very creative, very entrepreneurial, et cetera, et cetera. So, it, you know, you can still choose. You're not a victim even of the public system, let's put it that way. So that's doing doing like a full circle situation here. But it does lean towards creating cogs in a machine. And if you create lots of cogs and no free thinkers who can make decisions and improve and innovate, you're going to have a non-competitive society. And then those people that can't compete now need to be taken care of. They are the primary goal. They're the primary target of sort of welfare state, paternalistic state type of ideologies. When you go, well, you see, you have no choice. You're a victim of this and this and this. We need to give you, the government will give you this and the government will give you that, which of course it doesn't. The government doesn't produce wealth. People produce wealth. The government just takes the wealth that you and I make and then tends to distribute it a certain way, right? And, you know, when you create a massive bureaucracy that grows over decades, that's essentially what we see the result of right now in the United States even. But imagine that in other places where they never got the freedom. So we see countries stuck in just despair and extreme poverty because the powers stayed with the same people unchecked. The bureaucracies just keep on humming along. And, you know, and the whole thing is completely underwater, right? Failed state type stuff. It's all over the world. 72% of the world live on under authoritarian regimes. That's 5.8 billion, I think, something like that.
That's crazy.
It is crazy.
Yeah, I definitely saw that as an educator. And that's honestly like one of the big reasons that I left the public schools was because I just, I couldn't do it anymore. It was like my soul knew that like this is not the way. Like this is not the path to help kids to, like you said, really, I would say, thrive in their education. Like it was, I mean, even when you look at our reading scores, like it's insane what our reading scores are. I think it was like, I think now it's even worse. It's like 29% of fourth graders are reading on grade level or above grade level. And that is so unacceptable. Like reading really is the cornerstone to so many things, like your financial success and just even being taken advantage of. Like you can be taken advantage of more often if you are illiterate because you can't read and it's harder for you to get information and things like that. I mean, in the day and age of podcasting, you can get more information and, you know, audiobooks and things like that. But still, you know, you can get taken advantage of in the medical system or whatever because you can't read these documents. And so I think it's so sad that we are at a state where we are not even teaching the kids the basics. They can't do math. They can't read. They have very little understanding of history. They have very little understanding of science. And these are all very basic things that somebody needs to be successful in their life. And so I think that, in my opinion, I really hope that we can maybe adapt the public school systems. I don't know if that's ever going to be the case because I think it's such a big bureaucracy now that I don't like, unless we just like tore it down, I don't know. Like, that's why I go back and forth with school choice because people make really good points on both sides of school choice, right? Like you said, like the government gives you things, right? So the government might give you some money to go and go to a private school or go to this school or to homeschool or whatever. But oftentimes there's also strings attached with that, or they control what it is that you are teaching, right? Because in the public schools, even like we were told, this is your curriculum, like this is what you teach. And yes, you could kind of go off the curriculum and bring in different books, but sometimes you couldn't bring in these books. Like if you were, you know, I would assume, honestly, I don't know if you've heard of, have you heard of Tuttle Twins books?
No.
They are amazing. I think they are so, so cool. They basically are talking about what you're talking about, but it's books made for kids. So they have books on like a merit-based society. They have books on like the history of the United States. They have books on the history of communist societies and why communism, you know, doesn't work and why it actually hurts everyone. And they just have so many amazing books, but it's made for kids specifically. And if I'm like, if I brought these books in and I started reading these books to my class, I would probably get in trouble, honestly. Like, yeah, I don't think that they would allow that. Like, they would say, this is, like, too extreme. You can't be reading this to the kids. Obviously, I've never tested the theory, but I would assume that I would get in trouble. Like, they would not accept me to read those books to the students. And like I said, I get that, too. I mean, I think I kind of get it in so many different realms of, like, I want the parents to teach their kids this, you know. I think it's important that it starts in the home. And I don't think that the education system can teach history. I think we should definitely teach unbiased history, teach them to read, to write, to do math, things like that. And then I think that a lot of the things that they're trying to push into public schools is the responsibility of the parent. I don't think it's the responsibility of the school.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of part of the post-industrial model, right? Is that when you build a society where people start believing they're cogs in a machine, they believe in the assembly line, they project that and accept that as a reality in their parenting, right? So, like, I'll give you an anecdote. My middle child, Vivi, she was in first grade and we were in a public school. And I had three girls in three different schools, pre-K, elementary, and then middle school. So I'd take them all in the morning. And then I would pick them up. So I would take them in the morning, but maybe school started, whatever, 8:39, something like that. And then I'll pick them up maybe by 2-ish. So Vivi, my middle child, would come home. She would grab a bite. She would play a little bit. Then she would have dinner. And then do homework and then have dinner and then go to bed. So we would get her for, you know, a couple hours here, a couple hours there. That's it. She's seven. And I walked into the teacher's, set up a meeting with the teacher, and I said, explain to me how a seven-year-old needs to do homework beyond the hours that you know, I gave her to you. And the lady was really wonderful because she said something very interesting. She said, I wish I could teach your daughter. She was a true educator, that lady. But she was almost like a prisoner of the system. She said, I wish I could teach your daughter how she needs to be taught, but I can't. And that was a powerful thing. So, and I basically said, look, you have my kid during the most productive hours of the day. I'm not going to have her do homework. Like, you have my kid for like 5-6 hours straight. Like, if you can't teach a seven-year-old some essentials during that time, I'm sorry. I'm not going to, you know, make her do more work and not be present or not play. So I pulled both of my youngest two out of school and we homeschooled for 13 years. And that was a very conscious choice, right? And it's a sacrifice because it's expensive. Mm-hmm. It's expensive not only monetarily, but it's expensive when it comes to attention and time, et cetera. So my wife is the main hero of that thing. I sort of helped a little bit here and there. But what happened, and this is in the U.S., imagine that, right? So this is not Russia. This is not Germany. This is the United States of America. And as a result, so my oldest didn't want to be homeschooled. She was already too deep in, and she was in actually a really good magnet school, performing arts, tiny. So she had a lot of the same benefits that a homeschooler would have in a magnet school. So she was comfortable there, and then she went to a private school that is super, super tiny and very challenging as well. So she got a good education also. But the two youngest ones are probably the cleanest experiment, right, of the assembly line versus parents taking responsibility. You know, this is what we started with, you and I, right? And they are both extraordinarily successful, adjusted. They're crushing it in school. They're both in college. One of them is graduating like in a month or so.
That's amazing.
They already have jobs. They've worked since they were 13. Very not entitled at all. Super smart. High demand. Both of them have been making money for some time now, and have zero concerns about their future. And the reason for that is because they're not cogs, and they're not victims. You know, so that's one example for you.
Yeah. And I do think that's so important. And I'm going to be homeschooling my kids as well. Like that's my plan. I'm expecting my first one really soon. And that's kind of also why I quit. Like I was like, I don't want my child in the system because of what you just said. Like I know how the system works.
Yeah.
So deeply that I was like, I just can't do it. I can't put my kid in this system because I know that you can't meet the needs of all the students. It's just impossible because you have so many kids in your class. They have so many different needs. You have kids that might have, you know, traumatic backgrounds that they're working through and, you know, you have disruptions and you have like, it's so hard to ensure that every single child in that classroom succeeds. And that's kind of one of the, like I said, that was like the big thing for me. I was like, I know that this isn't, I went into teaching to educate the future generation, teach them to read, to write. I was an elementary school teacher. So I was working with those little 7-year-olds. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I also was a person that was like, I don't want to send home homework because I do have, like, if you want homework, great. Let me know. I can send you home with skills that they need to work on. But other than that, I think that it should be time spent with your child because I've literally had them all day long. And now you get to be with them and you get to teach them your values and your beliefs and whatever else that you want to teach them or allow them to follow their interests and, you know, so many different things, because that's the other sad reality in a public school is that children often are not given the time to explore their curiosity and their interests and to become good at something that they, you know, are innately good at and really hone in on these skills. And so I think that if you can take responsibility of your child's education, which I think every single person can, even if your child is in public school, absolutely. I think you can take that, you know, that responsibility. And
well, if you can't outsource parenting, that's the bottom line. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes people are busy or numb or whatever, unaware, and they outsource parenting.
Yes.
You cannot outsource parenting. It's impossible.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yes.
You can outsource education to a degree, but even that should be to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
Because really the formative skills, the character traits, all of these things are shaped by parents more than
anything else. And that's like the most important piece. I mean, like I said, it's, I mean, my plan in homeschooling is to teach them how to read, how to write, how to, you know, do math. And then from there, it's going to be providing them with a bunch of literature and providing them with unbiased history and letting them explore their interests and the things that they are going to thrive in their life and to find out what it is that they thrive in life. Because I, you know, going through the public school system and whatever, you get to your high school graduation and they're like asking you what you want to do with your life. And I feel like it's something that you just don't, I at least me personally, I didn't explore my interests really. I mean, I kind of knew that I really, you know, thought like child development was kind of interesting, things like that. But it was like I hit 18 and now they're telling me to start my life and do something that I love to do. And I'm like, I don't even know if I know what I love to do. Like, I don't know, because I wasn't ever really given the opportunity to explore those things because it was, you know, constant. I was in a lot of extracurricular activities as well. So I was, you know, going to school, doing these extracurriculars and things like that. So obviously, like I danced and things like that. So, but I knew like dancing wasn't going to be a career for me. Like it's something I love to do, but that's not going to be
all three of my girls danced through all through school.
Yeah. Like it was just something that I really enjoyed doing, but I was like, this isn't going to be my career. Like I'm not going to pursue this any further anyways. And so I think it's important for parents, even if you have a child in public school, to really, I think, and obviously there's not one study that shows that homework is actually beneficial for elementary aged kids. Doesn't help them academically in the slightest.
No.
So in my opinion, I'm like, no, like work with your child in what it is they find interesting and really develop that curiosity and teach your values, your beliefs, those character traits that are so important in life, and we'll do school when they come to school. And if you want homework, you can have homework. So one thing that you kind of talk about in your book, since we're on the topic of the family unit, you talk about how Americans have lost the sight of the importance of the family unit. So what advice would you give to American families on the steps they can take to reclaim or strengthen the family unit? Or what can we do as a society even to try to help people to see the importance of the family unit?
Well, I think there's a lot of, the thing is there's, even if you don't come from the faith side of things, right? And mm-hmm. I do, obviously. And I, by the way, I was raised complete atheist until I was like in my mid-20s. Mm-hmm. So I was raised in a complete spiritual vacuum. And there's a spiritual dimension to it where, of course, the role of the marriage, the role of parenting is a sacred thing. Marriage is a sacred thing. Parenting is a sacred thing. It's the greatest blessing you can have, actually, in life.
I agree.
So you have sort of this added layer of conviction and deep spiritual meaning to those who are faith people. If you're not a faith person, the data is still the same. The data shows that clearly if you want to have a happier life, live longer, be healthier and wealthier, you will find and build a strong family, a strong, mm-hmm. strong nuclear family, meaning your spouse, your parents, your siblings, very much your kids. You'll invest mm-hmm. in that and you'll have a better life. That's objectively true. The data is completely there. Mm-hmm. So I think for your sake, figure out how to do that. And I can tell you as someone who didn't know how to do that, actually, you know, I come from 3 generations of broken homes and I realized, mm-hmm. look, I can be super successful in my career. And I was entertaining mm-hmm. millions of people. I was on television, I was a celebrity, but I didn't have the family dimension strong at all. It was the worst. And I realized if I don't figure this family thing out, I'm going to be A, less successful professionally, also miserable. And I refused to be any of those things. Right? So I was mentored, I was coached, and I figured it out. And I have a great marriage. I've been married for 25 years. Super, super happy. My 3 kids love me and adore me and respect me. Mm-hmm. And to me, that is just such a source of joy and also a source of, it's almost like fuel to succeed professionally as well. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's profoundly important. I think in the latest sort of few years, that's just across the board. It comes partially... You know, people say, okay, people have less children because people are less sort of faith, you know, spiritual faith-based. Mm-hmm. They're more rich. That's partially true, but actually it's because of there's the spiritual side is not, no longer there. So if you look at any segment of any society, you can go to Western Europe and you go to the U.S., and mm-hmm. look at how the religious people, the people that have convictions about it rather than anything else, they understand the depth of it. Mm-hmm. All of them have more babies than their non-faith-based counterparts. All of them, you know, which is really fascinating if you think about it. You go, huh, so it's not wealth. It's a deeper understanding of the nature of life.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So... But on top of that, I think if we have ideologies that actively counter, they make it easier if, let's say, a baby's inconvenient. You know, most abortions are done not because of rape, you know, and this is the flag that people rise against abortion and stuff like that, against the banning mm-hmm. of abortions. And I'm not advocating for either or. I think it's a nuanced issue. Mm-hmm. But I think using... taxpayer dollars and the force of and the influence of the government to make it widely available and free for people is a big mistake. It's a socially mm-hmm. irresponsible and actually evil thing. Mm-hmm. I do believe that killing a child in vitro is evil. And mm-hmm. because I've been responsible for 2 of those before I became a believer. Mm-hmm. And I'll never stop regretting it, ever.
Mm-hmm.
Never, ever, you know? But even on if you just zoom out and remove sort of the moral dimension of that, society will die if we have less babies. Society mm-hmm. will die if we don't have strong marriages and strong families. That's just true. It's always been true, always will be true. regardless of secular, post-secular, wealthy, poor, it doesn't matter. So a society that develops a culture where family is respected, but family is cherished, nurtured, where marriages have the ability to thrive, and that's the example, that's the aspiration, rather than divorce at the first sign of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
That where children are a blessing, even though it's a sacrifice financially, emotionally, all kinds of ways, right, to have children.
Mm-hmm.
But the children are perceived as a blessing, a sign of great prosperity, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That society will win in the long run. Those are the sizes that won't collapse. And the societies that try to socially engineer those things, right, which you see that that's another evil aspect of sort of Marxist socialist stuff, is that they socially engineer things.
Mm-hmm.
They undervalue the power of the parent, the authority of the parent and the child. So, for example, mm-hmm. homeschooling. In America, this is just so basic. It's no longer frowned upon. It's not weird. It's not fringe anymore, right?
Mm-hmm.
You go to certain Western countries, it's illegal to homeschool.
Mm-hmm. It's crazy.
We're not talking about tyranny, stuff like that. Western countries, evolved economy. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And you can lose your parental powers for all kinds of things that are not actually dangerous for the child, right? Because the mm-hmm. idea is that the state trumps your rights to influence your children. The state has more power than you do as a parent. Mm-hmm. That's profoundly wrong, you know? So yeah. I think that's why these sort of fundamental things, if they're nurtured, defended, protected in a society, those are the civilizations, cultures that will prosper and win and flourish. It's part of the reason why I wrote the book, is that I didn't want it to be a political thing at all. It's really mm-hmm. more of an outsider's insight into what makes a society prosper, mm-hmm. you know, flourish. These are the environments. And America just happens to be a place where, honestly, I don't think it's really because we are, as Americans, better than anybody else, but we're very, very lucky, very fortunate, very blessed that mm-hmm. there's a collection of things that came together in this particular country in this particular time of history. And, mm-hmm. you know, so we're lucky, we are privileged, I think,
mm-hmm.
but not in a negative way. We're privileged, and because of the privilege we have, we better take care of the privilege that we've been granted, and mm-hmm. we better protect it and nurture it and speak up about it and don't think that this is going to remain automatically there. It can be lost yep. in a generation, right? So
mm-hmm. 100%. That's basically
why I wrote the book.
Gotcha. And like I said, I mean, like when I say like you're more American than an American, is because you really are, like, I see you as like a patriot in that way, because
mm-hmm.
the information that you are providing to people that I think everyone should understand, like you were talking about all of these characteristics, like people get stuck on the political thing and they kind of, you know, we go back to this like tribal mentality of like this side or that side is right mm-hmm. or whatever it is. And we really have to boil it down, like you said, to the fundamentals of what creates a thriving society. And I do agree with you that I think that families are the most important piece. And I also think that's why it's something that is trying to be broken apart, is because we understand, or not we, I don't know who that we is, they, I don't know exactly, understand the importance of the family unit and how the family unit can really be what fights this, what you would call the virus, right? Like this mm-hmm. virus of communism, Marxism, socialism, whatever. The family unit really fights against that. And I think it's maybe one of, I know you talk about antibodies in your book, maybe that's like the biggest antibody that we have, right? Is that family unit and understanding that children really are such a miracle. Like they really are a miracle. And, you know, in carrying my first child, I have really like seen obviously the process of like this little baby in even the very first time you see that pregnancy test, it's like, this is a soul. This is a person that yeah. I am now responsible for. And it really truly is a miracle. And you know, it's in our first pregnancy, I did have a miscarriage and then we were able to get pregnant again. And it's crazy how it's like, even if it's early on, you really feel that grief. Like you knew that human inside of you, at least as for a woman, right? Like you feel that soul and you have this deeper connection with your child. And so I think that family unit piece is so important, and understanding that life is precious and they are a miracle. And whether or not you believe in God or whatever it is, I think that it's important that we believe in something bigger than ourselves. But whether or not you believe that, I think it's important at least to understand that children are they're a miracle. They're a blessing and they can help you become a better person, I believe. And if we can really make sure that we're ensuring that children stay at the cornerstone, families stay at the cornerstone of what we're doing, our society will continue to thrive. So I totally agree with you on that. And I know that you have limited time here, so I just want you to share with everyone where they can find you, your work. I know you have a lot going on in all of these different businesses that you have, and you do a lot of, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? like you're a philanthropist as well. So like you give to other people in need and things like that. So where can they find you? Where can they find your book? Like tell everyone how they can find you.
So if you go to Amazon, you just put in my name, Christian Ray Flores, and you'll find the book right away. So yes, I would love for you to buy the book, read it, share it with, buy two copies, send it to a friend, right? That kind of thing. Another good place, if you want to just be in my information space, let's say. I have a Substack newsletter called, it's christianrayflores.com. The URL is very easy. It's just my name, right? And if you subscribe, you get two emails a week that are packed with value. So, and basically they're focused on success and significance, those two aspects of that we all want. If you feel like, oh man, I'm interested in the coaching piece, go to exponential.life. That's exponential without the E, starts with an X. And there's a really good assessment there, by the way, if you want to, where am I today? That takes probably takes 5 minutes to complete. It's about 40 questions. And you get a report in your inbox on, this is the state of the union. This is the state of your life. Okay, where do I go from there? So highly recommend taking that. It's called the Exponential Scorecard. It's on the website. You mentioned philanthropy. We do have an after-school academy in Mozambique, Maputo. It's one of the poorest countries in the world. And we provide children there that are in extreme poverty with Christian mentorship, English, and computer literacy. They get a meal a day. These kids are going to be out of poverty, inevitably take their whole family out of poverty. That's basically the deal. If you want to learn more about that, be a donor. We do trips every year, every 2 years. Go to the URL Ascend, as in going up, ascending, ascend.academy. That's the name of the project. That's basically my philanthropic work that I do now.
Awesome. And I'll make sure that the links are also in the show notes so that you can just go to the links and you don't have to remember all of this. So you don't have to write it down or anything. And you can just click on the link and go. I highly encourage everyone to read your book. Like I said, it was so, so good. And it is a fast read, but there's so much valuable information in there that I think every American should read just to refresh yourself on the values that we as Americans need to remember, not take for granted. And try to, as you know, an individual, bring into our lives so that we can, you know, make greater change in that way as well.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an update. Literacy is the foundation of learning, and every child deserves the tools to succeed. If you're ready to take the next step in your child's education, check out my website at k3homeschoolfoundations.com for resources, curriculum, and support to make literacy simple and effective.